A new study shows high levels of mercury in fish in some national parks, including Glacier. Good evening, I'm Connor Ballantyne.
And I'm Madeline Beck, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
We'll also tell you why the state of Idaho is suing a timber company. And in our feature interview, reporter Edward O'Brien talks with Montana's U.S. attorney about efforts to reduce violence on Indian reservations. A new study of 21 national parks, including Glacier and Yellowstone, has found elevated levels of mercury in fish. The study was done by the U.S. Geological Survey and National Park Service in 10 western states. While 96% of the fish show safe mercury concentrations, mercury levels in some fish were higher than is safe for human consumption. Colleen Flanagan Pritz is an ecologist with the Park Service and a co-author of the study. She says mercury pollution from the atmosphere comes from natural causes like volcanoes and from human causes.
Coal-burning power plants are a major source, and in fact, domestically, they comprise over 50% of the emissions to the atmosphere from that human-caused sector of mercury.
Researchers sampled a small number of whitefish and bull trout in Lake McDonald in Glacier Park and found mercury levels that exceed what EPA, using a conservative threshold, recommends is safe for unlimited human consumption. Fish in two other lakes studied in Glacier had safe levels, but it's not just humans researchers worry about. Birds and mammals that consume fish are also harmed by high levels of mercury.
It increases in concentration as you move up the food chain. So while there may be just a drop of mercury in the watershed, that can amount to 10 million times the concentration at the highest level of the food chain.
Pritz says more study is needed to establish baseline data for measuring mercury pollution levels in the national parks, which she describes as valuable outdoor laboratories.
And in other news from around the state, the medical marijuana industry continues its efforts to overturn restrictions in a 2011 law that sought to rein in the number of providers and users. Bozeman attorney Jim Getz argued a district court in Helena yesterday that even though the restrictions have been blocked by the court for almost 3 years, the law is still curbing the abuses the legislature sought to address. Lee Newspapers of Montana reports lawyers for the state argued that District Judge James Reynolds should make the ban on the commercial sale of marijuana permanent and limit each provider to 3 patients. Reynolds initially blocked 4 provisions from the 2011 law from taking effect, but the Montana Supreme Court overruled him in September 2012. Yesterday's arguments came after the Supreme Court returned the case to Reynolds for further review.
A Montana man charged with driving the suspect in an assault and attempted rape to Missoula after he escaped police custody in Bozeman has been arrested. The Bozeman Daily Chronicle reports 29-year-old William Michael Smith of Bozeman was arrested yesterday by police in Coeur d'Alene. He remained jailed there today. Smith was one of 5 people charged Monday with obstruction of justice for aiding Kevin Briggs after his February 1st escape. Briggs was arrested February 21st in Portland, Oregon. Gallatin County Attorney Marty Lambert said Smith was in custody in Bozeman from February 6th to March 20th when he was returned to Shoshone County in Idaho for a warning for a warrant alleging he violated his probation in a drug case. He was released from jail in Wallace on April 7th. A $100,000 warrant was issued for Smith's arrest.
A Helena jury was unable to reach a verdict in the case of a bartender charged with serving alcohol to an intoxicated woman who later killed 2 people in a drunken driving crash. The Independent Record reports jurors did find 57-year-old William Gleed guilty of obstructing a peace officer. A Montana Highway Patrol trooper testified that Gleed told officers to check 2 other bars for information on the driver. Gleed was charged under a state law that says it is illegal for anyone to sell or give alcohol to someone who is, quote, actually, apparently, or obviously intoxicated. Prosecutors alleged Gleed overserved 22-year-old Ariel Sheshke and a man in the hours before a crash near East Helena last April that killed 51-year-old Mildred Richards and her 16-year-old granddaughter, Justine Smith.
A Montana police chief says an unarmed robbery suspect moved his hands 6 times in defiance of an officer's orders before the officer fatally shot him during a traffic stop. Billings Police Chief Rich St. John said today the officer's decision to shoot 38-year-old Richard Ramirez three times was justified. St. John says a search of the car in which Ramirez was a passenger found drug paraphernalia, but no weapons. Authorities have not yet released the name of the officer involved in Monday's shooting because of general threats against law enforcement posted on social media. Adding to the concern, St. John says two of the deceased brothers are wanted on felony charges. Ramirez is the fifth person shot and killed by law enforcement in Billings in 2 years.
Missoula County officials have released the name of a Missoula man who died in a motorcycle crash on U.S. Highway 93 near Lolo. The sheriff's department said today that 22-year-old Samuel Forrest Fitch died of blunt force trauma to the head and neck suffered in a crash Monday night. The Montana Highway Patrol says Fitch was speeding northbound when he entered a right-hand curve. His motorcycle crossed the yellow line, went into the median, and struck a concrete barrier and a steel sign support to stop at the top of the barrier. The force of the impact broke the support. Fitch came to a rest on top of the barrier.
A 32-year-old Haverman died and two people were injured in a rollover crash just north of Harlem. The Montana Highway Patrol says the victim was driving a car southbound on Secondary Highway 241 at about 8:35 last night when the car went off the road at a left-hand curve. The car went through the ditch, hit an approach, and became airborne. The car landed and rolled onto its roof. None of the occupants were wearing seatbelts. The driver died at the scene. His name hasn't been released. The crash injured a 35-year-old man from Haver and a 36-year-old woman from Harlem. They were taken to the hospital in Haver.
A 58-year-old homeless man who kidnapped a Rathdrum woman in northern Idaho has been sentenced to life in prison. The Coeur d'Alene Press reports that Mitchell Lee Walk received a sentence yesterday in First District Court and must serve 20 years before being eligible for parole. Walk in February pleaded guilty to robbery, second-degree kidnapping, and aggravated assault on a law enforcement officer. In late 2012, Walk shot at Idaho police and eluded them during a car chase. He kidnapped a northern Idaho woman using her vehicle and traveled to Montana where he released her unharmed. He was taken into custody in North Dakota after pulling a gun on a trucker and being found hiding in a tractor trailer. He received a 10-year sentence for his crimes in North Dakota.
Some conservationists are miffed they weren't consulted before Governor Steve Bullock identified 5.1 million acres of national forest land as top restoration priorities. Bullock announced the nominations this month for the U.S. Department of Agriculture to consider increasing the pace and scale of restoration efforts. The Great Falls Tribune reports some groups criticized the governor for a lack of public participation in the process. Matthew Kohler of Wild West Institute says the decisions were based on the recommendations of a group hand-selected by the governor's office and Department of Natural Resources and Conservation. The group met five times with no public notice or meeting records. Bullock spokesman Dave Parker says the deadline to make the nominations was short and there will be future opportunities for the public to weigh in.
Idaho officials have filed a lawsuit against a timber company and its contractor contending they're responsible for a wildfire that killed a 20-year-old Forest Service firefighter and burned more than 300 acres in northern Idaho. The Lewiston Tribune reports the state filed the lawsuit Monday in Second District Court seeking an unspecified amount in monetary damages for costs in fighting the fire. Ann Vieseth of Moscow died August 12, 2012, after being struck and killed by a falling tree while fighting the Steep Corner Fire near Orofino. The lawsuit names Potlatch Land and Lumber, Potlatch Forest Holdings, Clearwater Paper Corporation, Potlatch Corporation, and Dabco Incorporated, a Kamiya-based logging contractor. Idaho officials contend a logging crew started the fire using equipment that didn't meet Forest Service standards required by law.
A federal Department of Justice advisory committee studying issues related to children's exposure to violence in Native American or Alaska Native communities is meeting this week in Florida. Montana U.S. Attorney Michael Cotter is there to share details about a pilot project taking place among the Chippewa Cree tribe on eastern Montana's Rocky Boys Reservation. In tonight's feature interview, Cotter and DOJ's Administrator of the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention, Roberta Listenby, discuss the scourge of violence on some tribal communities and what's being done about it. Listenby opens the discussion with some of the work that's been accomplished to date.
The first task force, which I co-chaired on behalf of the Attorney General, discovered the problems in American Indian and Alaska Native communities was pervasive. We needed experts to take a careful look at this, experts who know the tribal communities, experts who come from the tribal communities, so that we could discover in greater detail the dimensions of the problems and recommend some solutions. We're concerned that children who are exposed to violence have some pretty significant consequences. They have long-term physical, psychological, and emotional harm, and their exposure to violence leads to a higher risk that they might become involved in the juvenile justice or the criminal justice system. So we're seeking answers and solutions, and that's why we're meeting here in Fort Lauderdale.
And Mr. Listenby, when we talk about children exposed to violence, is that just another way of saying direct child abuse, or is it more broad than that?
It's much broader than that. We know from the National Survey of Children's Exposure to Violence, which was completed back in 2009, that a majority of American children were exposed to violence, crime, or abuse in their home, schools, and communities. This majority of children were exposed both as victims, sometimes as offenders. As a direct result, that we have these children who are responding to their exposure and sometimes acting out, their developmental path is derailed from the normal path of adolescent development. And in order to get them back on the right path, we discovered that they need to have trauma and trauma-informed care to address the specific needs that they have.
Yeah, how are they responding? How are they acting out and getting off the path, as you say?
To begin with, children who are exposed to violence have turned around and become involved in violent behavior or disruptive behavior. Sometimes they just act out in schools and are disruptive in the classroom. Sometimes they seek groups and peer groups that have destructive tendencies. Other times they engage in use of alcohol and drugs. And these kinds of things are often just a manifestation of the kinds of experiences they've had and the trauma that they've experienced. They're trying to find ways to deal with this while they go through their normal adolescent behavioral patterns.
And this isn't just having an effect on the young people, these kids themselves. It's also having an effect, it's got to be, on their communities.
It definitely is. For that reason, we're seeking to understand how this dynamic plays itself out throughout the community, and we're seeking the assistance of elders in the community, faith leaders in the community, so that we can find long-term solutions. We know that when communities come together, when leaders seek out answers to help children, that children are going to be more effective. We know from all the studies that we've done that a concerned adult in the life of a child has a great impact on that child's development and is very likely to help that child heal and become a normal, productive citizen in the society.
So what's going on in Indian country where this sort of violence is so pervasive?
Well, you know, I have Mr. Cotter here, and perhaps he can tell us some of his personal experiences.
Yeah, Mr. Cotter, welcome. What is happening?
I'll tell you, Edward. In Montana, I want to point out that the Attorney General is personally and professionally invested, and he's committed many years as a United States Attorney in Washington D.C. as well as the Deputy Attorney General as a judge in the D.C. area to children and their exposure and the negative effects that have occurred. So this is an initiative of his that came about in 2010, and Rocky Boy, the Chippewa Cree, has been a participant over the last 3-4 years in the program. They have developed, I think, a very robust program in the manner in which they deal with the issues on their reservation. I can tell you that the significant part of what they do is based on our involvement, the involvement of the communities that border the reservation, Hill County, along with the community of Haber, and identifying early on when a child is exposed to violence so that the appropriate services can be provided. I won't give you any specific case, but I can tell you how we operate this. There are some groups. They're called Child Protective Teams, Multidisciplinary Teams, and SARTs. The members of these groups are healthcare providers, doctors and nurses, child psychologists, our law enforcement. And that, from the law enforcement side, we have the tribal police, we have federal agents, as well as the county law enforcement is involved, and then we have the prosecutors. And so cases are staffed on a basis of every 2 weeks, Edward. And during those staffing, the children may be identified who are in need of services, and that allows then social workers who work on the reservation to go out and meet with the young person and provide the services that are needed. And oftentimes, we also utilize the traditional tribal matters and the Rocky Boys, and it's Chippewa Cree, it's the Peacemaker Circle. These are elders in the community that can follow the traditional approach in terms of helping with kids.
What does that mean, the traditional approach?
Well, it is using the culturally appropriate method in terms of dealing with kids who have been exposed to violence. And it's not only in the follow-up. If a kid has been a particular, perhaps a witness to a sexual assault or to an assault, or been a victim themselves to that event, but also not necessarily, but seeing the aftermath of such an event. And the elders, you know, can go and help process through traditional value, tribal values, and they have a rich culture with the Chippewa Cree, to adapt to the situation. There are also the clinical aspects of it with child services, child psychologists that can also provide help.
Is it true that, I don't know if I have this date right, but early on, maybe back in 2010, there were local surveys taken, and a lot of these kids were exhibiting signs actually of PTSD. Is that right?
That's correct. There was a survey done. In addition to post-traumatic stress, children at Rocky Boys, there was an indication that there was higher violent crime rates among juveniles. The rates of use of alcohol and drugs were increasing. Many children were not being raised in a traditional home, but were being raised by their grandparents. And there was an increased truancy and absenteeism in school. And I think that we've seen the positive effect by moving through into where we are today, that the project that is headed up by Trina Wolf Chief, who is the project director, has made great strides in this area. And I'm going to let Mr. Listenby comment as well.
I just want to comment on your question regarding post-traumatic stress disorder.
Yeah, please.
We have indications based upon at least a preliminary study that the post-traumatic stress disorder levels of American Indian and Alaska Native children are in some instances as high as our troops who are returning from Afghanistan and Iraq. So there are very high levels of post-traumatic stress disorder in many places, not all. And what we know, again, is that the normal adolescent development patterns are derailed by trauma at that level, and children do not get a chance to continue their development in a normal way. And unless we intervene with the appropriate trauma-informed care, we're not going to be able to get them back on the right path towards development. And overall, that's just one of the many things we're discovering. There are high levels of suicide among children who are both on the reservations and off the reservations throughout the nation. And we need to find ways to connect with these young people, to hear their voice. We need to listen to them and hear what they have to say about how we should be helping them address these issues. And we need to connect with them in ways so that they understand that we care about them and that the federal government cares about them and that the Attorney General cares about them and his staff cares about them in ways that are meaningful, constructive, and provide a long-term basis for us to address these issues.
Were many people, Mr. Cotter, in Rocky Boy reporting domestic violence situations, various forms of abuse, reporting these crimes to law enforcement, or were people just kind of keeping quiet about it, do you think?
Well, I think a couple things. There are instances where people do keep quiet with respect to domestic violence. But I think with over the last 3 or 4 years, with the presence of an assistant United States attorney and a willingness to prosecute those cases, they are being reported, they are being responded to, and they're being prosecuted. Just recently, under the Violence Against Women's Act, there has been oftentimes a non-Indian on a reservation who was married to an Indian who committed domestic abuse cannot be prosecuted, but that has been fixed and that has been changed. The President of the United States signed into law in July of 2013 the reauthorization of the Violence Against Women's Act, and in that there are specific provisions that close that loophole where a non-Indian cannot be prosecuted. Now tribal courts can undertake those prosecutions, and we certainly have done it on a federal level. The one thing that I want to tell you, Edward, as a country, and these are the words of the Attorney General, we have the creativity, the knowledge, the leadership, economic resources to effectively intervene. And we should do everything that we can to help these children.
So you're not saying the problem here is fixed and 100%, but at the same time, progress, it sounds like you're saying, is being made. And if that's the case, where do we go from here from this sort of pilot project?
Well, this is an advisory group that will prepare a report that will be given to the Attorney General later this year. And the Attorney General will respond to the recommendations coming out of this advisory group in terms of how he plans to go forward and deal with these issues. I want to make one other issue really clear. We recognize that many of the young people who are in the Native American community are very dynamic and also very resilient. The fact that they've been exposed to violence does not mean that they succumb to the challenges they face. We have many youth leaders across the nation. The tribal youth program that the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention supports yearly has various kinds of meetings across the nation, and these young people come out, and we have some dynamic, great leaders coming forth in the future. So they're going to help us solve these problems. I have every confidence. I've met with many of them. I even met one of them who plans to become President of the United States. So we should be proud of our young people. We should be optimistic about what they can accomplish. But we need to make sure that they get the tools to help us do what they can tell us to do.
Robert Listenbe, Administrator of the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention, and Montana U.S. Attorney Michael Cotter. Gentlemen, thank you very much to you both on this very busy day for you.
Thank you, Edward.
Thank you very much, Mr. O'Brien. Appreciate it.
And now for tonight's cloudy forecast. West of the Divide tonight should be mostly cloudy with a scattered rain and lows in the upper 20s to mid-30s. Tomorrow expect mostly cloudy skies with a chance of rain and highs in the mid-50s to lower 60s. For central Montana tonight, look for mostly cloudy skies and a chance of rain and snow with lows 30 to 35 degrees. Tomorrow should be mostly cloudy with a slight chance of snow in the morning and highs in the 50s. For southwest Montana tonight, expect mostly cloudy skies and a chance of rain and snow and lows 25 to 35 degrees. Tomorrow should be mostly cloudy with highs 55 to 65 degrees.
Currently, it's also cloudy in our listening area. Helena has 51 degrees with mostly cloudy conditions, and Kalispell is cloudy with 51. Butte has 44 degrees under cloudy skies. Great Falls is partly cloudy with 44 degrees. Here in Missoula, the temperature under cloudy skies is 45 degrees. It's 50 and cloudy in Dillon. In Hamilton, it's cloudy and 53 degrees. Libby has 47 with cloudy conditions. And in Polson, skies are cloudy, and it's also 47 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Susan Kohler.
Good evening. I'm Susan Kohler, CEO of Missoula Aging Services, the area agency on aging for Missoula and Ravalli counties. Tonight I want to talk about Older Americans Month, which takes place during May, and this year's theme, Safe Today, Healthy Tomorrow. I will also talk about how this theme ties in with a recent keynote address about aging in place, which I heard at the Montana Gerontology Society Conference. First, some background. Older Americans Month was started to lift up the countless older adults who have made sacrifices to ensure a better life for future generations. Since 1963, this celebration has recognized older Americans for their contributions and demonstrated our nation's commitment to helping them stay healthy and active. The theme, Safe Today, Healthy Tomorrow, is intended to focus with injury prevention and safety to encourage older adults to protect themselves and remain active and independent for as long as possible. Nationally, unintentional injuries to this population have resulted in at least 6 million medically treated injuries and more than 30,000 deaths every year. An emphasis on safety during Older Americans Month encourages older adults to learn about the many ways they can avoid the leading causes of injury, like falls. Here are a few basic tips. Ladies, stop wearing high heels. Get exercising, especially exercise that works on balance. Without proper exercise, most people begin to lose their balance starting as early as their 40s. Currently, the state of Montana promotes a class called Stepping On, focused on balance and fall prevention. It may be available in your community through your senior center, council on aging, or local hospital. Another tip, if you are taking medications, make sure you visit with your physician about how they might interact with other prescriptions and over-the-counter drugs, certain foods, alcohol, and other medical conditions. Adverse interactions can also impact your ability to drive safely, and even a minor accident can have severe consequences as you age and become more frail. I want to spend some time on the last tip. It has to do with what you need to do in your home if you intend to age in place. Aging in place is the idea that our homes are the most desirable and economic place for housing and care. Therefore, making your home safe and prepared for whatever disability may affect you is very important. I mentioned tying this in with the keynote address at the recent Montana Gerontology Society conference held in Missoula. Among other themes, their theme of Foundations for Successful Aging explored the need to look at universal design in the home. Keynote speaker Louis Tenenbaum, a former carpenter and contractor, is now a leading thinker, speaker, and consultant on aging in place. His focus is on universal design of existing and future homes. This concept means designing and building homes to be aesthetic and usable to the greatest extent possible by everyone, regardless of their age, ability, or status in life. Tenenbaum consults with families, builders, developers, and product manufacturers on universal design solutions and is the founder of the Aging in Place Institute. Much of what Tenenbaum discussed was about building safe environments to age in place. He maintains that building homes using the universal design concept increases a home's marketability since it appeals to families with young children just as it does to people who have disabilities. Across the nation, communities are adopting visitability ordinances that push for a minimum standards. Visitability means that the home has a zero-step entrance on an accessible route at the front, back, side, or through the garage. It also requires that all main floor interior passage doors have a 32-inch clear passage space. A half or full main floor bathroom must have a basic maneuvering space, meaning a 5-foot turning circle and an open floor plan in which a wheelchair can maneuver. Additional tips include good lighting, grab bars, and no throw rugs. Tenenbaum's talk was well-timed because on April 7th, Missoula City Council passed this very ordinance. That doesn't make visitability standards mandatory. Only state law could do that. However, an incentive built into the ordinance states that anyone submitting a visitability design will move to the front of the line during the permitting process. From what I understand, that should be a good incentive. I'm proud that our city demonstrated its commitment to helping people of all ages, especially those who want to age in place. If you want more information on visitability or helpful ways you can modify your home in order to age in place, contact the Rural Institute at the University of Montana, Summit Independent Living Center, or City of Missoula's Development Services. This is Susan Kohler, CEO of Missoula Aging Services, and as always, thanks for listening.
Susan Kohler is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of this station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Madeline Beck.
And I'm Connor Ballantyne. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.